Welcome to Plastic Model Mojo, a podcast dedicated to scale modeling, as well as the news and events around the hobby. Let's join Mike and Kentucky Dave as they strive to be informative, entertaining, and help you keep your modeling mojo alive.
All right, Dave. Better late than never, man. Woo-wee.
I know.
Good grief. Nice to be back in the modern world.
Yes. Light other than by candle is something that's kind of nice.
Yeah, the fireplace gets kind of hot when it's not that hot outside. Not cold outside, I mean. Man, it's a tough week. So, yes, listeners, if you were following us on the Facebook, on the Dojo, you know, Dave and I here in Kentucky, along with a lot of other people, endured some pretty severe winds. It'd be a week ago today.
Yeah.
We're recording this on Friday. We usually record on a Sunday, Monday kind of cadence. And boy, not this time.
No. Well, I was ready to go. I don't know what your problem was.
Not on Sunday, we weren't.
Yeah, well, you know, I had it back Sunday night, so I could have recorded, but yeah, no. All joking aside, I'm tempted to complain that I lost power for 24 hours and it was a real pain and how it set my modeling and my mojo off and all. But if I complain, I'm afraid Mike's going to come out from behind the microphone, get in his car, drive to Louisville, and slap me like Will Smith slapped Chris Rock.
That's right. And pull the meter on your house.
There you go. Because
bring it back 5 days later.
as listeners probably don't know, we did have record windstorms. Lots of people lost power. There were 100,000 homes in Jefferson County, which is the county where I live in, that were without power, and it took 4 and 5 days for some of those people to get power back. Now, I was particularly lucky. We lost power, and we lost power for just right at 24 hours, and then it was back. Mike didn't have the same experience that I did, and I'm here to tell you 24 hours without power was bad, but it was a lot better than what Mike went through. So no joking aside.
Well, it's back on now, and that's water under the bridge, so I'm almost scared to ask, Dave, but what's up in your model sphere?
Well, my model sphere was severely set back by the terrible power outage we had. Oh, I'm not going to do that. My model sphere is rushing to finish the Musaru before the photo entry deadline, and I'm going to have an innovative entry, and we'll see about that. But I'm also trying to anticipate getting up to HeritageCon. I am looking forward to this. I cannot tell you how much I am looking forward to going up to HeritageCon, to seeing the folks who put on HeritageCon. I've heard the show praised by everybody who attends or has attended in the past. And I kind of want to see it for myself. I'm getting a little bit of the mini excitement that I get when nationals are close. How about you?
You know, I'm all excited about that too. And I need to touch base with Mr. Model Airplane Maker there and see about some of the plans that are being fomented behind the scenes.
This could be a very fun weekend, or it could end up in the headlines in the local newspaper and not in a good way.
That's true. But I don't know, man. That aside, I've enjoyed some of the conversations we've had about my current modeling peeve.
Which one is? Oh.
Which we have affectionately dubbed Sidewater.
Sidewater. And for some, we all have these peeves. And for some reason, yours doesn't bother me. But man, does it get under your skin.
Well, we can get some feedback on this one.
Yes.
Sidewater is when you do a diorama base and you dam up some acrylic resin water, and when you finish the diorama base, all the edges of the diorama are black or some neutral, non-visibly distracting color, except this vertical look into the depth of the water. And I think that's just not a good look.
Now, this does not bother me at all, with one exception. The one exception where I completely agree with you is where the water isn't, the side water isn't clear, so that you can't see into the river bottom or creek bed or whatever. And I've seen those occasionally, and I completely understand the objection to that, because if you can't see into it, why would you do it at all? As far as the ones where you can actually see the work that's been done in the creek bed or the river bed or the pond or whatever, those don't bother me, but they do seem to bother you a lot.
Yeah, I think they're a visual distraction, because it just, it robs realism, because you're getting a visual that you can't get in nature, at least not very easily.
That's a very engineer's objection.
So that's firmly and wholly owned my opinion. What do folks think? I think people do it that way because that's just the way people do it, and they don't think about it any further. I mean, if you have the side of the water exposed, why not just have all the roots and fossils and crap? And I've seen that done too.
I have. In fact, I've seen that done in
the rabbit hole.
I've seen that one done in a World War I trench diorama.
Yes.
Where you see the, you know, embedded skeleton and the rifle and the helmet in the dirt on the edge of the cut portion of the trench.
So I just have a feeling my preference is it's an all or none proposition.
Yeah. So you like what Night Shift does where he covers all the edges.
You know, he may have done some sidewater too.
Did he do a sidewater once? We'll have to go back and look.
I don't know. So tell us what you think, folks. It's probably just my peeve.
Mike, after 5 days without power, I hope that you have in your hand a modeling fluid.
Of course. It's record night. I've got something.
I hope it's something good, given what you went through.
Well, it is. It's my new second... My alternate favorite again. I'm back on that Russell's Reserve 10-year, man.
I'm surprised I didn't get drunk completely while you were going through 5 days without power.
Well, I had a little bit of something else during that. This is fairly new bottle.
We know you're not going to be disappointed by it, so that's good.
Well, I'm curious to see what you've got, because you drank all your Christmas beer last time.
Well, again, my wife, affectionately referred to as the model wife, who has never listened to this podcast at all, but at Christmas, as a present, she bought me a 6-pack of variety beers that to use as modeling fluid when we record, because of course we had talked about the podcast and I talked about doing that. Well, the last recording was the last one of those, and so I told my wife I had run out, and what do you know? She delivered another 6 beers. So this is another one that the model wife got for me. It's called Quite Bright. It is a Belgian-inspired wheat ale from Bell's Brewing in Comstock, Michigan. I accused my wife of choosing this particular beer because Bell's is in Comstock, Michigan, and Comstock is her maiden name. So 5% ABV. And so far, it tastes good. We'll see how it gets me through the episode.
Well, I like Bell's Two Hearted Ale.
I've had Bell's Two Hearted before.
I've not had what you're drinking, so I'm curious. Well, man, if that's your modeling fluid.
That is it.
We do have a nice selection of listener mail this couple of weeks since last episode.
Good.
This first one might be a repeat. I can't remember without going back and looking at the... I forgot to star all my emails last time, so I'm kind of... putting a stake in the ground with this one. Rock Rozak, another detail and scale book. Did we talk about this one last time?
Which detail and scale is this? The Thud book?
This is the Thud book. This is the F-105.
We did talk about this one last time.
Well, Rock, you get the double dip, so latest detail and scale book on the F-105 Thunder Chief, F-105 Thunder Chief detail and scale. Check it out, man. It's a good looking book on a workhorse of a jet.
And that thud is just, you're right. Workhorse describes it beautifully, but there's something about it that is just really great looking.
Well, Dave, Rock's a good guy. Always, always happy to support detail and scale. And
always like seeing what new stuff he's got coming out.
Up next is from Ontario, Canada. I wonder if our friends up there know this gentleman, Mr. Victor Constantinescu. It's not bad. That's a long name.
Yeah, that's challenging.
He's in university, so he thinks he's one of our younger listeners. I bet he's not the youngest because we've had a few teenage folks chime in. But Dave, he's looking forward to us being at Heritage Con and coming by and saying hi.
I'm looking forward to that as well. Like I said, I've got kind of a mini buzz version of what I get for the like 3 weeks before the Nationals, where I really start chomping at the bit.
Now, he interestingly has a question. He wants to know if we know of any good products to use first time concerning making water from epoxy resin or something.
Just don't make side water, no whatever side water. You do.
You know, Victor, if you will just, I can probably get you an answer from our guest, Steve Husted, but I think that's going to be the topic of our next time with him anyway, is water effects. So if that's not a front burner kind of project, it's to me a chiha. He wants to make some, you know, resting away in some shallow lagoon kind of thing, like discovered in the 1980s kind of deal, I guess, which would be cool. Unless you do sidewater, then it won't be.
We're going to have to get his take on sidewater.
If that is a to be determined build date and finish kind of project, you can get all kinds of answers here. Hopefully, in the next few episodes, we need to talk to Steve about when he's coming on. But
he's supposed to be going to Heritage Con, so we can sit down over either his preferred martini or our preferred bourbon and have that discussion.
You bringing the kit?
Am I bringing the kit?
The bar kit.
I'm bringing the bar kit, and I'm bringing a bottle of Weller. So we're going to be well equipped.
That's a good martini, Dave. A martini glass, a bunch of Weller, and maybe a rock, maybe not.
There you go.
Victor, we look forward to meeting you.
Yes, absolutely.
Ah, another Canadian, Dave. Man.
Telling you what. Our north of the border fans can't wait to see him in person.
Well, he's a repeat offender. Danny Saint Laurent, Quebec City, Canada. He's given us a topic. I won't disclose it because I like to keep those under the deck until we break them out and actually use them. But he's thanking us for the show and all we do for his mojo. So, Danny, we appreciate you interacting with us, and we will take your topic under advisement. It's an interesting question, probably a little more than we want to get into with listener mail. So hang tight.
And all of you, we really appreciate the suggestions for topics, either for the wheel or for a full-blown episode. You know, Mike and I, we'd sit here and talk about anything model related, and it's really nice for listeners to give us suggestions so that we're talking about something. And sometimes these topics are something we never really thought to talk about. So we appreciate that.
Well, Eric Simmelmeyer is back and from Redwood City, California. So over to the West Coast. He's got some questions here about clear parts. Some of these were not addressed in our segment with Dr. Strangerus last time.
Maybe we'll have to include them.
Because that was mostly gluing and masking.
Right.
Because he does ask, what's the best glue for clear parts? What do you like to use, Dave?
Well, I like to use, here it's in front of me because I was using it on the Arma P-51. Deluxe Materials Glue and Glaze. I really like that as a canopy gluing. I know some people that, you know, some people that glue them with super glue, and, you know, I'm always afraid.
That's what Miller does, right?
I know. And I'm always afraid of the fogging. And, you know, I've heard that if you dip it in future, that prevents falking.
That was the spiel from Dr. Strangebrush, right?
Usually by the time I'm attaching a canopy, I'm really far into the build. And so I become more and more afraid of committing the error that kills the build. So I suspect that's probably why I'm hesitant to do that. But then again, that's, you know, that's something I'm fighting against all the time, is trying not to be, you know, I'm conservative by nature, but I think more risk-taking would probably help my modeling in the long run. So who knows? Maybe the next one I'll do it.
Well, a couple of these are other two bullets he's asking here, and we've touched on the glue a little bit just then and referenced back to Dr. Strangebrush. But window fit, how do you sand clear to make it fit? I guess opposed to, you know, the more colorized styrenes that tend to be a lot softer.
I don't have any problem sanding clear parts as far as, you know, on edges to make them fit.
Do you just use your normal assortment of sand and sticks and files and stuff?
You were anticipating where I was going. The one thing I do when I'm dealing with clear parts, I probably grade down. In other words, if I would normally use a 400 grit sanding stick to put the, you know, to sand the remains of a sprue gate or a nub, or, you know, I'm sanding to take a little off to make a part fit. With any clear part, I usually go down. So instead of a 400, it'll be an 800. Well, I guess that's technically go up, but I'm going down to a finer grit.
Sure.
You know, a lot of modeling is taking your time, and, you know, some people might get impatient, but one of the good things of modeling, having Skippy come over and sit and model next to me sometimes, speaking of which, I need to get him back here again, is that he is the most patient modeler I have ever seen. Now, that does slow him down, but, I mean, he will sand and fit and sand and fit and sand and fit. And by taking your time and not getting frustrated and grabbing the 80 grit sandpaper, the big metal file or rasp, it pays off. But yeah, clear parts, you really, I use the same stuff. I maybe just use more delicate versions of the same stuff.
Well, he's struggling with the 70s era Hasi B17 with, you know, windows out the wazoo.
Now, if he's talking about, you know, like the little cheek windows, the ones that are, you know, they're not canopies, but they're actual windows in the fuselage, those can be real challenging.
Well, it's now, it's a double challenge for him because, what was he building? He was building a Jolly Green Giant helicopter.
Oh, okay.
Now, it's now a paint mule because he's punching the windows back into the finished fuselage.
Yeah, yeah.
Might be a glue issue, he says. Yeah, probably is.
Probably.
Now, I tell you, if you're really ballsy, and we've been watching those, God, who's that guy on YouTube building all the old vintage Airfix stuff?
Greg's models.
Greg's models, where he just glues those suckers in like concrete and then
polish them.
Sands the crap out of them and polishes them back to a shine. I mean,
and that is one technique to do. You glue the clear part in, not worrying at all about, you know, fine fit or the polish or trying to avoid whatever. Because the truth is, with clear styrene, you can always polish it back to clear. Now, it's a lot of work, because, you know, you're using 4,000 grit, then 6,000 grit, then 8,000 grit.
And tail of your t-shirt.
Right. Yeah. And then you've got the wax and the polish. And
toothpaste.
Right. And then you hit it with future once. So it can be done that way. Now, like I said, that's more work. But yeah, you're not going to punch a window out there. Now, the opposite version is to not use the clear plastic at all and use something like glue and glaze or what's the
crystal clear?
Crystal clear or VMS makes a product as well. Same thing.
Maybe theirs is good. I mean, I don't know, man. Those never look right to me.
Well, I think the problem a lot of people have with them is they just put in the one layer.
Yeah.
And call it that at that. And if you're dealing with a fuselage that has a round side, the problem is you get a window that either is flat or concave, but you can actually build that stuff up in layers one at a time and get yourself a window that looks good. But yes, I understand the hesitancy with doing that.
Well, hopefully we've either created more work for him or answered this question, Dave.
Or both. You know, yes and.
I want to try that glue it in and sand it flush deal, man. All right.
It works. It's just
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Up next, Dave. Michael Reese from Bavaria. I don't know where in Bavaria. I don't know if he's from München or where he's from.
Listen. A Bavarian Jägerschnitzel is one of my favorite meals at Hofbräuhaus, so I'm very pro Bavaria.
Now he's friends with Bruce the Model Noob and Panzermeister 36.
Okay.
Bruce Worrell and Evan McCallum recommended us to him. He's been taking it in. He's got some nice stuff to say about our delivery method as far as how it relates to non-native English speakers, so. I never really thought I'll send you this one, Dave. It's a really nice one. So, Michael, I really appreciate this. And I think Dave will too. National drink in Bavaria is Weissbier.
My favorite beer.
And he says if we ever need one, he can step up if we need an expert.
Oh, man. I would love to have a conversation with because, again, I like beer and I really like wheat beers. So I could talk for a long time on that subject. But, you know, I had never thought about folks listening to our podcast who are not native English speakers. You know, I don't know why. We're obviously the majority of our listeners are in the U.S. and then the places that follow are Canada, Australia, Britain. But we do have a fair amount of listeners from places like Norway and Sweden and stuff like that, where English is not at least the first language. So that's interesting. You send me that email. I'd like to read it.
I will. Up next is Jason Campbell, and he's looking forward to us making it to Knoxville. Should we be able to make it to Knoxville? He's primarily the Gundam guy.
Yep.
And he's got a topic for the Wheel of Accidental Wisdom.
All right. We got to do another one of those.
Stocking the wheel, man. We obliterated it last time. So try to have no repeats as long as we can pull that off.
Yep.
And to be honest, folks, we hope to eventually, once we get this thing established, maybe one more, and then we're maybe going to turn it into a prize affair.
Yep.
Because that would really make it fun.
Yep. And, you know, because with this new software, we can do what we've done once before and do the call-in type show. And I would love to combine the wheel with a call-in type show.
There's an idea.
Where we get one caller, each caller gets one spin of the wheel and a chance to opine on whatever comes up.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I come up with a good one every once in a while.
And that would free up an episode if we double dipped on that to free up for something else.
There you go.
You're the model of efficiency, Dave.
Well, I'm not sure.
Except at your workbench.
I was going to say, I'm not sure the Moosaroo bears that out, but we'll see.
All right. And finally, our great friend and contributor from New York City, Michael Karnauka.
All right. He's going to have a question.
Of course he is. He's like a character on the show now.
Yeah, that's right.
Seems trite to be asking a question when you and Dave face a hurdle in your daily lives as serious as the one you've befell both of you. Hope things get back on track as soon and all as well as can be. Well, thank you for that. Yes, power's on and being consumed in copious amounts to make up for the 5 days.
Yeah, that's right.
What is the most unusual place you have encountered a model kit or accessory or book while doing something like being on vacation or perhaps to a store that would not carry such an item? Does that make sense?
Yep.
And what would have been?
Now, this one isn't mine personally. I'm going to steal this one from Alex Restrepo, our good friend Alex. Alex was walking around and found at a yard sale a short run resin kit of, and gosh, I wish Alex was here. It was one of the items from, I think, the Alien franchise. You know, the armored car or the drop ship. It was one of those. And he found it on a table, unbuilt, on a table at a freaking yard sale. And, and of course, this thing had been long out of production. And, you know, it was rare as hen's teeth when you could find it. And if you could find it, you would go pay an arm and a leg. And I think he paid, you know, it was on a table, like $5 or something, some small amount.
Well, it's probably less than that. That'd be a big ticket item at a yard sale, $5.
And he bought that and actually built it. I remember him on Saturday mornings when we were working at the shop, him actually building it and telling the story of having found it. So, Alex, if you're out there and I got any part of the detail wrong, please email in because that's one of those things that's just you once in a lifetime type stuff.
I don't know. I see a lot of stuff at like antique malls and stuff when I go in there. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, you'll see a vintage kit or something.
Yep.
But more in the spirit of what he's asking, I can't think of anything that I've stumbled in on that wasn't, you know, was out of place. You know what I'm, you know what I mean?
You do occasionally run across an antique mall or an antique shop where all of a sudden there's a couple of plastic kits and they tend to be stuff from the 70s and 80s. I remember, you remember Billy Carter?
Yes.
There was a model kit released, I think, of a pickup truck.
Yeah, Billy Carter's pickup truck.
And I saw that at an antique mall once, but,
I know one. This is kind of interesting. Back home in Johnson City, Tennessee, it's not there now because this chain of stores is completely gone now. It's McCrory's.
Yep.
McCrory's, it was like a five and dime store.
Yep.
And they were in the mall and they were one of the original stores when they built the mall in Johnson City. They're long gone, but you know, it had a lunch counter and everything. They didn't have model kits and stuff normally. But usually, sometime in early January, right after Christmas, they would get in these shipments of like all the plastic building kits from Tyco for model trains.
Yeah,
so, you know, so all the people got train sets for Christmas. It was completely calculated. It had to be.
Oh yeah.
And so they get like a pallet load of this stuff in. They'd fill these gondolas up with this stuff, and it'd be like a dollar. And stuff would be dirt cheap. But one time they did that and it was all the, it was Italeri, the testers Italeri boxings of the Italeri kits.
Well,
all the tanks and it was all the 35th scale stuff. And that was kind of one of the, I was in elementary school because I remember me and one of my friends both got some of that stuff. That's a long freaking time ago, man. So yeah, that was misplaced and well, not. It was somewhere unusual and we'd find that stuff and it was cheap. It's like the $2, $3, $4, $5, you know, for the anti-tank guns and figure sets and some of the bigger vehicle tanks. And, you know, for $10, you could walk out with a big stack of stuff, keep you busy for days and days.
Yep.
And I got a couple of anti-tank guns and the Ferdinand or elephant anti-tank gun and something else. I can't remember, but, big fun. Dave, that's it on the email side of things. What's been going on over on Facebook Messenger?
Well, not as much, but that's probably my fault as much as anything else, because between the power outage, the Moosaroo, and everything, I haven't been as active, particularly on the dojo, as I mean to be. But two things. One, our good friend Ed Barrett sent us some musical riffs, some bumps. that we're going to start utilizing in the episodes. And he was very kind to do that. I can't wait. I don't know if you plan to use them in this episode, but you'll see those coming up soon.
Yeah, man. I appreciate that, Ed. And Ed, in fact, is our guest in our next episode.
Well, good. We'll talk about his music.
And we can thank him live there. But Ed is a retired engineer from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a real rocket scientist. And now as a retiree, and probably, I don't know if he'd done that before.
Yeah.
He's probably always been a musician at some level, but now he's playing in some bands, I think. And I asked him for a little favor to support the show in a non-monetary way, and he obliged. And man, it's cool. It's actually kind of cool, man, because, you know, we got Bob did our intro and an ad for us, and now Ed's throwing us some bass licks that we're going to use for bump music. So it's kind of cool, man.
Hey, it's a collaboration. The other Facebook Messenger that I wanted to mention was you, Stephen Lee, and I were on Facebook Messenger talking about various subjects. We have a running Facebook Messenger DM between Stephen and Mike and I. And we were talking about the fact that in the U.S., you've got fine scale, but that in the U.K., there seems to be a much larger number of modeling-related magazines coming out of the U.K. as opposed to the United States. And not necessarily coming up with an answer as to why that is, but it's noticeable. And given the size of the modeling communities in each country, I do find it fascinating.
There's a lot of things going on in the UK versus the US. It's not just print magazines. It's like the number of attendees who make it to Scale Model World.
Yeah.
Versus the population of that country.
Yep.
And how that compares to the IPMS Nationals and the population of this country.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a disconnect there somewhere. I would really, that's a whole nother ball of wax.
Yep. I would like to dive into that because, I mean, clearly there are certainly flavors to modeling in different countries as far as level of interest, you know, the magazines and stuff. And well, it's just like we've always known that the Japanese market is completely different than anywhere else. And, yeah. And, you know, we know that we don't see half the stuff that they make there that is consumed wholly by their internal markets. And it's just a fascinating twist on our hobby. And I would love to occasionally, if we do this over time, I mean, talk to people from other countries, have them on as guests and talk to them about the similarities and the differences in the way the hobby presents in their country as opposed to here in the U.S. or in Canada, which I think is similar enough to the U.S. that it's pretty much the same.
All right, man. Is that all you got?
That's it. Well, this is the point in the episode where, as always, I ask you to, if you haven't, go and rate Plastic Model Mojo on the podcast app of your choice. Give us 5 stars. It helps to raise the visibility of the podcast. Also, if you know somebody, a fellow modeler, who isn't into podcasts, hasn't listened to podcasts, tell them about our podcast. Recommend us to him. Help that person. You might have to help them download a podcast or show them how to download or listen online. It's a personal recommendation from a current listener is the best way for us to continue to grow. And we do continue to grow. It's fantastic. And a lot of listeners that we are getting now have been people who have gotten recommendations from other listeners, so please do that.
Even in Bavaria.
Even in Bavaria.
Well, subscribe too. Subscribe to the podcast.
Yes.
If your player allows you to do that, that's always great. In addition to that, please check out all the other podcasts out there in the model sphere. You can do so by going to www.modelpodcasts.com, model podcast plural. It's a consortium website set up with the help of Stuart Clark at Scale Model Podcast up in Canada. And if you go to that URL, you will find banner links to all the other podcasts in the model sphere who are participating in this spirit of cross promotion, along with us and, just helping each other out. I mean, we've got a lot of audience overlap. Let's just put it that way. And, we don't think it makes a lot of sense to divide it up. So we're sharing, I guess, Dave.
Yeah, that's right.
In addition to the podcast, we've got some other folks out there making great content in the form of blogs and YouTube videos. The InchI blog, the InchI guy, Jeff Groves, and all things 72nd scale. Now, you got to see him recently, didn't
you? I did. Got to see him up at the IPMS Columbus show, where he showed me some photographs. He's doing another one of his batch builds. This time it's ME109s. And I think he's now started a batch build of fine mold ME109. So his productivity is just flat out amazing. And, you know, one of the reasons I look forward to shows the way I do, particularly the shows in this area, is I know that I'm going to get to see Jeff. And, you know, that's always a good day, sitting around talking with him at a show.
Well, we've already mentioned Stephen Lee and a sprue pie with frets. Check him out. I'm hoping some of these conversations we have will spur him to write a little bit on some of this stuff.
Yep.
Sprue pie with frets, Stephen Lee. Chris Wallace, Model Airplane Maker. We've mentioned him too, because he's our stinking liaison for our little Canada trip coming up.
Yes.
He's had some, he had an interesting video lately, and, it gets better every time. And his blog or his YouTube channel are constantly improving, and he's gaining some momentum, and we appreciate all he does. And finally, Jim Bates. Jim, come on, man. Scale Canadian TV.
He's going, I talked to him today. He is going to drop an episode, particularly to abuse me regarding the Musaru build. But then again,
whatever it takes, man.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I told him.
Well, there's your excuse. You flubbed the Musaru
just so
Bates could get spurred on to start his blog again.
There you go. And that's not everybody. You left somebody important out.
I have Mr. Evan McCallum, Panzermeister 36.
There you go.
Who's had a pretty good clip of videos here lately, and rumor has it he's got a couple in the bag.
Yes.
Dave keeps goading him on, but no, he's
that's right.
Evan's an independent man. So he's not gonna be swayed by your pressure, Dave.
Probably not. But man, I will tell you that Evan, he's been doing YouTube since he was a fetus. I guess. I mean, it's amazing how long he's been doing it, and his videos are just fantastic. And he's got a really good style that has developed over the 8 or 10 years that he's actually been doing this. And I will tell you that every time I get an alert that he's dropped a new video, I almost immediately go and watch it. So I'm looking forward to the next one, Evan.
And for an inside joke, which we rarely do, use PZM36 at checkout. That's all the plugs for me.
Well, finally, if you aren't a member of your IPMS national organization, IPMS USA, IPMS Canada, IPMS Israel, please consider joining your national organization. The IPMS national organizations do a lot to help the modeling community in their country grow. And my understanding is that IPMS Australia is going through a reformation, and so they may end up with a very dynamic national organization shortly. So I'm looking forward to hearing about all that.
Well, that's good. That's more than I've heard. I heard they got their charter pulled.
Well, that was a prelude to a recharter.
Yep, put it in better hands.
Yes.
Well, Dave, let's have a word from our sponsor and this episode's guest, Model Paint Solutions.
You got it.
Plastic Model Mojo is now brought to you by Model Paint Solutions, your source for Harder Steenbeck airbrushes, David Union power tools, and laboratory-grade mixing, measuring, and storage tools for use with all your model paints, be they acrylic, enamels, or lacquers. Check them out at www.modelpaintsolutions.com.
Dave, it's time for the Benchtop Halftime Report, brought to us by Tackett Z. TackettZ.com, the must-have tools for the model maker. Was Ed at Columbus?
No, he was not. In fact, that's one of the things of vendors at Columbus. There were very few manufacturers or internet retailers or any of the more formal vendors. It was very, very much people liquidating kits, collections and such like that, as opposed to like what you would see at an IPMS National.
Well, that's where you find the deal.
Yes, that is true. I did pick up some deals.
Well, Dave, what's on your bench?
Okay, you know what's on my bench. Everybody on the planet knows what's on my bench. The Musaru, the Arma P-51, which will be done for HeritageCon. It will be on the table at HeritageCon. And
just like the Buff was at Nationals.
I didn't promise the Buff at Nationals. This is a Mosquito at Nationals 2 years ago that didn't make it. But I've been obviously solely working on it to the exclusion of everything else. I've kind of made a resolution to myself, and that is, per the conversation that I had up in Cincinnati with Barry and Jeff about building faster. And if you build faster and build more, that the skill will develop from doing that. I'm becoming more and more convinced that that is correct.
Well, for you.
Well, okay.
I didn't mean that in a pejorative.
Yeah, sure you did.
I just don't think, I don't know, man. I'm not willing to sacrifice the quality to get faster. I don't think faster is that important to me.
Well, what my hope is that by building faster, well, one of the ideas that I've had is that, and Alan Hall, actually, for those of you who don't know, Alan Hall was the publisher for years and years of the British magazine Scale Aircraft Modeling. And he did an editorial once where he talked about that modeling and modeling skills aren't like riding a bike. That if you don't utilize them, they degrade over time. And I think that's true. And conversely, I think that by using them more and more and more and more quickly, that they will get better and better. So I'm thinking that this year I'm going to at least try to take a run at that and see at the end of the year what I think about it. So that's my bench and my modeling philosophy for 2023. What's your bench look like?
Well, what did I talk about last time? Had I finished the little kilometer post last time? I think I have.
I think you had just finished the kilometer post last time.
So we won't talk about that. I have started weathering the catapult boom. Well, the whole catapult, for that matter.
Right.
Well, no, the boom, because I already weathered the launch mechanism, didn't I?
Right.
You know, this is going to be interesting, because this gets into another one of our running conversations with our Ottawan friends. So I'm going through this weathering process on this catapult, and it's got all these really lightly molded, you know, the relief is really shallow.
Delicate
on a lot of the rivet detail. Which, you know, doing the wash and come back with the damp brush of spirits and taking it off is not working real well. Well, it's working, but it's just a lot of work.
Yeah.
It makes me think that hearkening back to the old paint wash dry brush days might actually be a better strategy for this thing. I don't know. It's too late now because I've already started. I'm not going to do one side one way and one the other. That won't work out too well.
Well, you know, there are cutting edge products out from some major manufacturers with both dry brush brushes, dry brush paints, and it's everything old is new again.
Well, that's the key, and that's kind of the running joke on our conversation is everything old is new again, and it's funny because one scale model rock star in particular was panning this technique early in their career as a scale model rock star. And then now they're offering dry brush paints and dry brush brushes and, you know, whatever. I don't really care. I find the irony and humor in this.
Yeah.
Is enjoyable. It's funny to me.
Well, I'm
because there was a recently published ad that called dry brushing an advanced technique.
Yes.
and I made a joke. I guess it was today that, if dry brushing is an advanced technique in 2023, then man, the folks like me were way ahead of their time. And when I say ahead of their time, I mean like lost civilization or visitor from another universe ahead of their time. I mean, come on, man.
I want to tie that back to what I was talking about, building faster and whether it will help you develop skills. One of the things that I do think is possible that will come out of that is finding techniques that speed up your modeling. That by building faster and doing more, it lets you say on the next model, instead of doing what you're doing on this catapult, you'll do it by doing wash and dry brush. And you find out, well, yeah, that looks are equivalent, and I was able to do that in half the time that I did the pin wash and you know, come back with the spirit technique, which took a whole lot longer. So that is one of those benefits that I'm looking to hopefully pull out of trying to produce models faster.
So that's what I got on my bench. The KV85, other than throwing 10 tracks together every now and then, is on the back burner.
Yep.
Though I don't know, man. I really want to get this thing done.
Yeah.
Catapult and plane, and I'm not promise I'm gonna get it done before Nats, but man, it'd be great if I could.
Yes, it would.
Well, that's on my bench, man. That's all I got.
So, Mike, have you been spending any money? What broke your wallet?
Not a lot, but I can drop a few nuggets this episode.
All right.
I picked up, it's for the KV85 project because I'm using 3D printed resin tracks, which won't let me do the, you know, the burnishing fluid deal like the metal tracks will.
Right.
And then sand it off with a sanding sponge to get the real metal effect after that. Right.
Right.
Can't do that because they're made out of resin.
Right.
So you can, back to dry brushing, you can dry brush or brush paint the tops of the cleats with, you know, a metallic color, right?
Right.
But I tell you, if you look at folks who do that and you look close enough, somewhere on there, they've got silver paint on the mud in the tracks.
Yeah.
And once you see it, you can't unsee it, right?
Right.
So I don't want to do it that way. So I have this idea I want to try where I actually paint the tracks in a lacquer metallic,
mm-hmm.
at least the areas that are going to be exposed.
Yeah.
Do all the subsequent weathering in acrylics and enamels, acrylics or enamels, I guess.
Yeah.
And then use white spirits or, I don't know, an alcohol
mm-hmm.
to go back and swab all that crap off the cleats to reveal the lacquer metallic underneath.
That'd be... two things. One, I'll be interested to see it work. In theory, it should. Two, I'll be interested to see the amount of effort that is required to yes. remove back to the lacquer, because that might be the downfall of it.
It could be.
Is that it could take a lot of effort to get those other layers back off.
It could. So I'm going to try on some other tracks besides the ones for the kit, obviously.
Yep.
Not going to cut my teeth on the real thing. But this is not the Bench Time Halftime Report segment. It's the What Broke Your Wallet segment. Right. So what broke my wallet? I bought two Tamiya LP range. I bought the silver and the gunmetal, and I'm thinking a blend of those two in some ratio will give me the color I want.
Yep.
And that's what I'm going to try this with.
Okay.
Because everybody's raving over these LP paints. And I'm like, you know, I've been spraying Tamiya with using a lacquer thinner.
Right.
Instead for airbrushing instead of their acrylic thinner. And it's pretty stinking nice the way that goes down.
Yeah. I've got some of these.
I just don't know how much better it can really be. And now the metallics maybe, the metallics should be in theory a lot better.
Yeah.
Because typically acrylic metallics, they're not all bad, but most of them aren't very good, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now, I have three of the lacquer, the Tamiya lacquer metallics, and then I've got four World War II Japanese colors. I have yet to try any of them yet. I acquired them about 6 months ago, and I'm like you. I've heard people rave about them, and I kind of want to see for myself.
So, you know, it's just learning something new, and then maybe I'll be smitten by them and go from there. We'll see what happens. But that's what I bought. And then I got something in the mail today. This is money spent a while ago that I failed to remember for a prior installment of What Broke Your Wallet, Dave.
Okay.
Today in the mail, I got issue 129 of AFV Modeler. So I finally subscribed to this outright.
Yeah.
Normally, I'd pick up whatever copy was current on Brian's newsstand.
Sure.
At Scale Reproductions. But, you know, I was like, you know, of all the magazines I peek at through the year, you know, I buy the occasional copy here and there of whatever.
Yeah.
This is the one that always makes me smile and has the most kind of content in it that I like.
Sure.
So it's not cheap to subscribe to this one overseas. But something else I noticed, it doesn't say Ming AFV Modeler on it anymore.
Huh.
Okay.
I wonder, do you know if they have an electronic version?
I do not know. But
because I get my SAMs electronically now, and that has worked out for me.
Well, I like the hard copy.
I understand.
Well, that's it, man. That is all I've bought. But I am saving up quite the roll to take to Canada to Heritage Con.
And once you change it into Canadian, it'll be a much bigger roll.
And I'll have to put it in both pockets.
There you go. Well, as far as as I said in last episode, my wallet got broken because I bought a Cameo. I have, because of the Musaru, I have yet to do anything but open up the box. But I'm looking forward to utilizing that. I did go to Columbus. And I did pick up a couple of deals. Well, deals and otherwise. Skippy, for a very late Christmas present, got me the Sword G4M1 Betty, the early version of the Betty, the one that comes with the markings that Yamamoto was shot down in, which, of course, is the bird you want to do if you're doing a Betty. In addition, I picked up a Special Hobby KI-43, and then I bought three Shores and Cull books, Fledgling Eagles, Bloody Shambles Volume 1, and then Yugoslavia and Greece 1. I actually had two of those three books already, but these were at a very, very inexpensive price. So I bought them because I knew Skippy didn't have the Fledgling Eagles one, so I gave it to him. And then the other one that I already have a copy of, I'm going to sell or gift to somebody because that's just those books. They are too good of books for me to walk by a table where they are ridiculously low priced and just leave them there. So I spent a little money at Columbus, not a huge amount, but I'm like you. I'm husbanding my resources for Heritage Con. So all you Canadian vendors, you need to bring your best stuff and you need to price it cheap so that Mike and I have to smuggle stuff across the border.
All right, man. Hopefully after this Musaru thing's behind you, man, this your bench will get a little more kicking again.
My bench is going to get busy, buddy. I'm telling you.
All right.
Getting the right sized base for your model, diorama, or vignette can be difficult and time-consuming. Bases by Bill has the solution with their all-new custom-sized display bases. Offering sizes of 4 to 30 inches, you choose the dimensions you want and get the size you need every time. And they can laser engrave the base with a unit emblem or text, all to your specifications. Better still, shipping is included within the lower U.S. 48 states. Built by modelers for modelers, Bases by Bill has bases and display cases for any type of model and for any size. Visit their website at basesbybill.com to see their products or to get your own custom-built base or display case quote. Use the code MOJO at checkout to apply a 15% listener discount to your order. That code again is MOJO for 15% off. Bases by Bill for all your model display needs.
Well, Dave, our guest tonight is Dr. Strange Brush. The title of the segment is Get Into the Groove, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that fear-inducing activity called scribing.
I need a prescription from the doctor because this is one of my weaker areas of modeling. So let's get to it and listen to what he's got to say.
Well, Dave, the good doctor is in the house again, Dr. Strangebrush, Dr. John Miller. John, how's things?
Things are well. How about yourself?
Well, they're good for me now that the electricity's back on. But I tell you, this is a topic tonight that I think it's one of those topics that it's like the modeling skill equivalent to knowledge is power. Because I think folks struggle with particularly aircraft models and sanding seams and stuff because of all the crap they're going to obliterate doing that. And knowing how to fearlessly step up to the plate and rescribe lines or scribe lines where there are none on a kit you paid a lot of money for, maybe, is something that would be very useful in the bag of tricks. So, John Miller, we're going to talk about scribing tonight.
We are. And I have to preface this by saying, I want you to understand how honest I mean this. I mean, from the bottom of my heart, I hate scribing.
Yes. Amen, brother. Preach.
I just loathe it.
Preaching.
Okay? Truly. And, you know, I liken this to, you know, that old adage, if you want to get something done, you don't give it to somebody who has a lot of time. You give it to somebody who's like, you know, has a full schedule. You ever heard that?
Yep.
So if you want the best approach, or at least the least painful approach to scribing, you don't go to somebody who likes scribing.
I don't think outside of a mental institution there is such a person.
Does that include people that maybe should be institutionalized?
Well, maybe so. We'd have to debate that. But seriously, John, I'm exactly the same way. You want to talk about the list of things that not only do I hate to do, but that are most likely to go wrong at some point during the time that you're doing it?
Yes.
That's scribing, man.
Yes. It's evil. It's an evil thing.
It is.
It is. And because it's an evil but necessary evil, I've spent a lot of time coming up with the what I like to think is, you know, the easiest approach to making what is the most loathsome chore of model building just a little bit more palatable. So when we go forward here, just keep in mind that everything that we're going to talk about, at least my experience on scribing, is based on what I do at the bench and what I've been doing for about the last 20 years. So with that in mind, you know, the first thing I like to impress upon everybody, you know, who's going to think about scribing or rescribing a line is you have to be patient.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Well, there's one thing that I think in the discussion of any of scribing and rescribing that I think has to be the start point for the entire discussion. And that is the less you obliterate, the less you have to rescribe.
I couldn't agree more.
Because, I mean, you know, I used to be much more carefree when it comes to sanding off seams and such, and not caring nearly as much about all that I was obliterating and right. then find myself faced with, well, great, now I've got to do more of the thing I hate the most.
Right. Yeah. And that goes for even when you're, using an aircraft model as an example, when you're putting the fuselage halves together, right?
Yeah.
At first you put those things together and you put a little time into, making sure they're aligned. But once you get into the whole scribing game, you put way more time into looking at the inscribed lines on each side of the fuselage halves and making sure as best you can that they're aligned.
Yeah.
Because if not, right, as you know, half a millimeter, full millimeter off between the two, well, you're going to have to end up having to fill that in and kind of blend it over the top so you don't get that, you don't get that Z shape.
Wave shape, yeah.
Yeah. So I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree. Spend a little time thinking ahead, both when you're gluing the model together, when you're filling seams, when you're putting putty on the model, take a step back and make sure you're not going to be making more work for yourself down the line by filling in an inscribed line.
Well, and that you mentioned that putty, which I think is an important point. I was talking about avoiding obliterating by heavy-handedly sanding. Mm-hmm. More than you need to. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing applies with putty. Don't put more on. Be precise in your putty application rather than just slopping it on thinking, well, I'm going to sand most of it off anyway.
Right, right. Put as little as possible.
As little as possible.
And here's another one for you. Let's say you're again, aircraft model reference. If you've put a wing to the fuselage, the Spitfire, and you have a ridge where the wing fillet on the fuselage meets the wing fillet on the right. wing. That makes sense?
Yep.
Okay. You may want to think ahead a little bit and going to whatever side is higher than the other, whatever side is more proud, right? And inscribing that line a little deeper before you blend the fillet in.
Yeah.
So, it's going to look like a trench before you start blending the fillet in. But by the time you blend the fillet in, that trench will hopefully, if you have the right touch, it'll be roughly the same width and depth as the inscribed lines around it.
Gotcha.
So you can always prescribe a line. If you know you're going to be sanding and blending, in a given area, think about prescribing that line a little deeper than it already is in anticipation of losing a little bit of material off the top.
Well, with scribing, I think probably, other than taking your time and patience, I think probably one of the most important things is what you use to rescribe. So yeah. I want to hear what Dr. Miller prescribes when he's prescribing a scribing tool or scribing tools. What is his prescription?
Well, let's back up before we get too far down the road. I'm sure sure John's got an outline or something.
Well, you know what? It's funny. Dave is like following my outline almost point for point.
Okay. Well,
I've got those cameras in your house, and they come in handy from time to time.
And I was just assuming he was derailing it. So
no, not at all. He's right. All right. And the thing is, I put choosing the tools as pretty much the first segment here to cover.
Well, I did that in choosing a podcast host.
Because that's
thank you, Mike.
That's a key consideration, and in if you're going to be doing some scribing, is what tools are you going to use? And there are a plethora of scribing tools out there, and I have tried most of them, from the old squadron scribing tool that looked more like a dental pick, thing to
because it was
exactly. To the Ulfa, to this, to that, to used airbrush needles, to sewing needles, to yada, yada. And after many years, and this is going to sound like a shameless plug, but let me preface this by saying that anybody who spent a little time on Model Paint Solutions knows that really the site is an outgrowth of my bench.
Yeah.
So if there's a tool on the site, I can guarantee you, ooh, what I almost said. That it's going to be on my bench. There are no tools that are on Model Paint Solutions because it was a good deal or I got a bulk, deal or something like that. So that said, I'm very pleased and proud that I have the UMM series subscribers 001, 2, and 3 on my site through a special relationship I have with John Voyachek at UMM USA. And if anybody knows John, you know this guy does some top-notch tools.
Yep. I was going to tell you that the scribers that I have that I use 95% of the time are those three scribers.
Yes. You're just exactly right. And I've tried all of them.
Yep.
And these are the ones that I settled on. And long before I started Model Paint Solutions, I had these three scribers, on my bench using them every day.
Yeah.
So when I started Model Paint, I made a special relationship or a special arrangement with John to put these scribers on the site. And the thing about them is, they're a V-shaped blade, okay, and they're exceedingly sharp.
Yes, they are.
And the thing is, each one of the scribers, 1, 2, and 3, what I find the most handy about them is that blade shape is reproduced on both the pulling end of the tool, which is where you put that blade, on the plastic and you pull the scriber across the plastic to inscribe the line. You can also turn that tool around in your hand and use the other end to push the line.
Right.
And the blade on the pushing end of the tool is exactly the same angle and aggressiveness, if you will, as it is on the pulling side of the tool. Well, and where I find this most helpful is, if you can imagine just for a second, go to your mind's eye. One of the most difficult things to deal with in a scribing situation is something where you have a 90-degree angle.
Yep.
And you have a line going down the vertical side of that angle and then making a 90-degree turn onto the horizontal plane of that angle. And most scribing tools, you can get close to that corner, the very crux of the angle, but you can't get the tool into the corner. With the UMM tools, you can drag that line up to the corner and then turn the tool around and push the line into the corner.
Yep.
And I gave a lot of thought to how to explain that. And that really is, I think, one of the best aspects of those tools is you can get them into corners and continue your line. The other thing is, if you spend some time with those tools, you'll find that the 001 is probably the most aggressive blade. It's the one I actually use the most of, unless it's a smaller scale or finer lines, in which the 002 is absolutely ideal.
Yeah.
The 003 is somewhere in between the two with regards to aggressiveness and blade size.
Yep.
So you can kind of match the tool to whatever the inscribing is on the model, right? So I can't say enough about these scribers. These are my favorite scribers. But there's one more scriber in my toolkit that's just as important as these, and that is a small and a large needle point scriber, perfectly round.
Do you have anybody particulars in mind?
Well, it just happens to be the case, Dave.
We're good with those transitions, man.
The Profile Accessories makes a really nice needle scriber that I've had on the site now for a couple of years. And in one little package, you get both a small needle and a large needle, and a fitting on each end of the tool to put those needles on at the same time.
So where do you think the needle, as opposed to the blade style scriber, which UMM 1, 2, and 3 are, where does the needle come in handy?
Well, it most often comes in handy working on curves, because what I find is, especially if you're trying to scribe a curved line and you've used some of this rubberized tape, that you can get a very nice, curved line out of the tape. It sticks really nicely. 3M makes it. It's going to be going up on the site in the next week or two. I've been sitting on it for a while. And it comes in 3 widths. It's a 3M product, and it's often used for masking, painting masking for curved lines, but it's also really good for scribing. with one caveat. Since the tape is a bit rubbery, so it can conform and go around curves, it's a bit soft. Right. So when you go to lay your scriber up against that tape, if it's a curved line that you're trying to scribe, if it's a scriber with a blade, like one of the UMM scribers, it's going to grab into that rubberized tape.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're using a rounded needlepoint scriber, you can get it right up against the side of that slightly soft tape and just very carefully follow the contours of it and not have the blade dig into the tape and ruin your line.
Well, and something you said there that I think is really important is you talked about laying it up, the needle up against the tape and then just dragging it. In other words, not trying to actually, at least initially, engrave. You're more dragging it initially just to create the line that then all your scribing afterward is going to follow.
Once again, you now have me concerned that indeed you have photographs of my outline.
Yes. Well, you know, those Chinese spies are not cheap, but they're worth it.
Yeah, you know, I put it up on TikTok last night. I figured it would be fine.
There you go.
So that's actually the next section I have here is what I try to do, again, since I've suffered through scribing for too many years as an airplane guy. My big thing was always the wing fillets, horizontal stab to vertical stab fillets, panel lines, that kind of stuff that would either be lost or filled in with putty, and you'd be forced to deal with a curved surface that you were rescribing into.
Yeah.
So because of that, I've kind of come up with what I'd like to think is like a two-step process for inscribing the line, exactly what you were inferring to earlier. But, and again, this is probably the most important aspect of talking about scribing is like this process of a two-step process, if you will, of a pilot line followed by deepening the line.
Mm-hmm.
So again, let's say we're going to be rescribing a line that you can kind of see a faint ghost of the previous line that was there, right? That was a inscribed line that you've sanded or blended, and you have a little remnant of the line there, right?
Yep.
So the first thing I would do with that is, if there's enough of the remnant left to get a good guide, I would go right to a UMM scriber, probably the 001 or 2, and I would actually use the hooked end, put it in the remnant of the line, and push the scriber along the line. And it's surprising how much more control you have over the scriber if you're pushing the hooked in versus trying to pull it and actually pull plastic out. And when you're doing the pilot line, the idea is not to necessarily deepen the line at all. It is simply to keep the scriber in that remnant of the line and move the scriber multiple times. The idea is not one or two strokes with pressure, but six or seven strokes with very little pressure, but a lot of accuracy.
Right. So almost just the weight of the blade or the weight of the needle scriber in and of itself with no pressure being applied by you or your muscles.
Exactly.
You're just dragging it or you're just running it along the line to
exactly. In fact, the needlepoint scriber that I've got on the site that comes from Profile, it's actually got a fair amount of heft to it. I like heavy tools.
Right.
I don't like light tools. And that is almost heavy enough that for a pilot line, especially if you're using the small needle, you can rest the needle on the model and almost let the weight of the tool give all the pressure that you need when you're scribing your pilot line.
Yeah.
And that's just in preparation for what would be the next step, which would be deepening or actually scribing that line once you have put a pilot line in to guide the scriber.
And the reason for the pilot line is that once you've established a groove, once you've established even the lightest groove, anything you come in and do after that is going to naturally follow.
Right.
Whereas if you're trying to do that with pressure in your initial pass, then you're not guided anywhere, and it's much easier to go left or go right when you don't want to.
Yeah, that's where I think most of my mistakes are made earlier on, is skipping over the pilot line step.
Yeah.
And doing one or two passes and saying, okay, well, I've refreshed that line enough. Now I'm going to put some pressure on it and get this thing done.
Yeah.
And then it goes left or right on you. And then you've got this big dig in the line and you have to go back and fill it in and then rescribe. So you've made so much more work for yourself than slowing down. Again, back to the patience thing, especially for scribing. This is one where patience on the front end will save you heartbreak on the back end.
Yeah.
So completely I'll go back different. Again to that pilot line once again, and just using the slightest pressure, maybe 6-8 strokes, I'll establish that line so that then I can switch to phase two, where I'll go back and I'll rescribe the line now with a little bit of pressure. Again, no, I don't want to deepen that line with one or two strokes. I want to deepen it with 3 or 4 or 5 strokes,
yeah.
Light strokes. Again, once you start putting pressure on the scriber, you're asking for the thing to deviate out of the line and give you a problem.
Yeah. And have you noticed the variation in plastic quality between kits or manufacturers really does have an effect on your scribing technique or your scribing?
Without a doubt. And if you're working with like some of the newer Airfix kits, I find that plastic to be surprisingly soft.
Oh, unbelievably soft, which yeah. is both a positive and a negative.
Yes, exactly right. It responds really well to Tamiya thin cement.
Yeah.
And you get these beautiful, you know, splooge when you, if you do the seams right, you know, you put the model together and you get the splooge, you know,
right.
The
molten. Trim it off and.
Yeah. Yeah, much easier than, let's say, old Fujimi.
Right.
Which would be the opposite end of the spectrum, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, Mike knows about that.
Yeah. Extra thin won't even work on that kit that I'm building.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's one reason why it's nice to have a selection of scribers so that if you are working on, let's say, an Airfix kit, I probably wouldn't, if it was a 72nd scale kit, because, you know, so many variables here, right? But if you're dealing a 72nd scale kit, I probably wouldn't pick up a 001 to rescribe it because, number one, the blade is just too aggressive for that soft plastic.
Yeah.
So for something like a 72nd Airfix kit, I would switch over to a 002.
Well, and something I wanted to comment on that you alluded to earlier regarding John Wojtek and these scribers.
Yeah.
These things are designed, and I'm sure he has somebody manufacture them, but he designed them, and he's a modeler, first and foremost.
Yeah.
He is a modeler. And so all three of those designs, when you pick them up and you put them in your hand, they fit naturally in the hand the way you would hold them as if you were a modeler going to do that exact job.
Right. Exactly. Because they were made by a modeler.
Exactly. As opposed to, say, the old squadron scriber that's a dental tool that's been fiddled with.
Right. Exactly. And the thing about John, not only is he a master modeler, he designs his own tools. He also has his own production facility. He makes his own tools.
I was wondering about that because these things are, they look, for want of a better word, they look bespoke. They look as if these were hand manufactured just for you by the art, by the bladesmith that does the work.
Yeah. And I can tell you something else on these. You're exactly right. I had my first 001 lasted about, I'd say, 7 years, maybe 8 years,
mm-hmm.
before the blade finally started showing signs of dulling.
Yeah.
And I used that on every model I did for 8 straight years. So that gives you something, gives you an idea of how long these tools will last. And I can't say that enough. I didn't finish a model without using that 001 Scriber during that period.
I still have the original 001 that I bought from him. Yeah. When it came out, he first released it. And I swear the blade is still as sharp as, of course, now I don't finish as many models as you do. But yeah, these things are really, really in a world where everything is mass manufactured in China and the quality isn't, you know, it's going to be whatever happens to be that day. These things, the quality is just unbelievable.
Yeah. And I've had them on the site now for a couple of years, and I've sent a whole bunch of them to customers, and I don't get any complaints. I mean, that's the bottom line. I get emails back with, my God, what, you know, where was this thing, you know, 5 years ago?
Yeah.
If you try them, you're going to like them. That's my experience. But again, not to sound like a dead, you know, beat a dead horse, you really can't also do without a needle scriber to go along with them.
Right. Because there's some jobs you just can't do with a blade.
No, you can't, because it's a shaped blade.
Right.
And for some applications, you want a round, you know, needle, not a shaped angled blade. And something else we didn't talk about earlier about doing curves is the use of photo etch scribing guides.
Yeah.
Now, these are really handy.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're made by a whole bunch of companies. Lion Roar comes to mind. They make a whole bunch of them. Edouard makes a whole bunch of them. The old Hasegawa scribes, if you can find those are really nice.
And there are a whole bunch of different radiuses.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you can, there's one template, I think it's either Hasegawa or Lion Roar, that is nothing but, you know, parabolas.
Right.
And, you know, a photo etch that you can match to whatever you're working with. And the nice thing about the photo etch pieces is that you can bend them to conform to curves. You can tape them in place. Right. Yep. And those are particular. Another good application of another good use of a needle scribe over an angled scribe is to put your pilot line in. If you're using a photo etch, you know, guide, you know, try first with a needle scribe. Because that rounded, you know, rounded point is going to abut right up against the side of that photo etch guide and slide along it, versus a V-shaped blade that's going to catch on the photo etch. Yeah.
So what's next on your outline? It's a little blurry on the photograph I've got.
One last point on those photo etch templates. Don't be afraid to bend them. Because you can always go to Lowe's or Home Depot and get yourself a big pair of duckbill pliers.
Yep.
And spend a couple of minutes with duckbill pliers, and you can bend them just as flat as they were when they were brand new. So, a lot of guys are like, oh, I don't want to bend it. No, you can bend it, because you can always straighten it afterwards.
Yeah. So, it's meant to be bent.
Yeah. And then also one more tip on that, and shameless plug time. Again, on the site, because I've used it for years and I've had good luck with it, is a plastic scribing tape, about 3 millimeter wide and 6 millimeter wide.
Is this the clear stuff?
This is the clear stuff.
I purchased this from your site, and I really, really like it.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's slippery, isn't it?
It is. And, but it's slippery, but it's both. And this is really weird to describe. It's both stiff yet pliable.
Yes.
Which is really, really a combination you wouldn't think you could get in a material.
Yeah. That's why I put it on the site. When I first tried it, I thought, man, this is the stuff.
Yep.
So that what I like about it is it's very sticky. So once you put it on the model and you burnish it down, you know, with a burnishing tool, it is not going to move.
Right.
So you can put a fair amount of pressure on it, and it's going to be right where you put it. The other thing is the material that it's made of, it's a very slippery or slick plastic. And so it there are no burrs, no rough edges anywhere on this tape. It's perfectly smooth on the edges. So the scribing tool slides along the side of it. And if you first take that scribing tape, and it's easier with the 6 millimeter, it's a little wider to work with, put that on a piece of glass, grab yourself a straight edge and a brand new X-Acto blade, cut yourself a strip of that scribing tape that's maybe only a millimeter wide,
mm-hmm.
And what you can find is you can actually get that to conform to a surprising degree of curve.
Right. Like wrapping it around a fuselage
or a cowl.
A cowl. There you go.
And that's always a real bugger is, you know, if you've got a cowl, especially, and the line is always going to be on the front portion of the cowl that's, you know, that's curved.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's probably one of the harder ones. And for that, you know, it's either find yourself a photo etch guide that has the appropriately sized hole, or what I like to do is go to that, the clear scribing tape, cut a thin strip, get it to conform around the cowl, and then use that as a guide for a rounded scribe or a needle scribe first. And then once I make my pilot line with the needle scribe, I pull the tape off and I'll switch to a 002 or 001, depending. And then I'll use that pilot line to actually scribe the line.
You made a point there that I wanted to emphasize because I don't want people to miss it. You talked about this tape not having burrs or imperfections.
Yeah.
If you're using any sort of tape to guide your to be a masking guide or a engraving guide, any burr, any defect in the tape will be reproduced in whatever you engrave.
Worse, it'll be magnified.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I agree.
And you know, I'm not sure that people realize that when they, you know, you can't just rip off any old piece of tape, lay it down and use it as a guide. If it's not got at that perfect edge, which this clear tape, the scribing guide tape really does.
Well, we've talked a lot about this tape. We've not said exactly who makes it and what it is.
All right. I just know it off of Dr. Miller's website, a scribing tape, clear, 3mm. Who does actually make it?
Hi-Q Parts.
Okay. I think I saw that on the
page. Hi-Q Parts makes it, and I'm lucky to have a distributor that consistently has it in stock because it goes in and out with other distributors. And it's made by Hi-Q Parts and it comes in 3 and 6mm. It's a big roll.
Yes.
I mean, one roll is going to last you a couple of years.
Yeah. It'll last you forever.
Yeah. So anyway, it's Hi-Q Parts.
Now we've gotten people scribing. We've gotten people using guides. We've gotten people using pilot lines and all that. But inevitably, occasionally, you will make a mistake.
Before we get to the mistake.
Oh, I've jumped ahead in the outline. Sorry.
Obviously, your photograph was blurred.
Yeah, it was blurry. Sorry.
Before we get to the mistakes, let's think about back to that perfect, which doesn't exist, but that perfect line that you've just scribed. So first you put your tape down, you used your needle scribe, and you put in a nice pilot line. You pull your tape, you switch to a 002, let's say. You scribe your line, everything is looking good, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you get the tiniest little shards or tiny little roughness on each side of the inscribed line. If you put your 3X cheaters on or your 5X cheaters and take a look at the line, you can see that it can be, depending on the plastic and all the variables, it can be a little rough on each side.
Right. Burrs.
So, yeah, burrs. Good. Yeah, good word. So burrs. So what some guys do, I've not actually ever seen it done, nor have I ever tried it myself. But some guys say that they take Tamiya thin cement.
Yep. I do this.
You do this?
Yes.
Well, wow. Because I don't have the guts.
Well, but now here's the one thing you do. You're not putting glue down in a line. What you do is, you know, you take the Tamiya extra thin, you get 90% of it off the brush so that if you ran it on your skin, it would feel almost dry. And so then you drag it along that line and what little is left will melt that little, because these burrs are very, if you've done your job right, these burrs are very, very fine.
Yeah.
You just want to eliminate them.
Yeah.
So no,
that makes a lot more sense versus putting a drop and letting it by capillary action run the whole length of the line.
Yeah. No, yeah. I get, it's almost like dry brushing. You get 90% of 95% of the fluid off the brush.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yes, so, I have done that.
So that's not a trick I've actually tried, although after you described it like that, I will give that a go next time. What I've been doing for years is just getting the, I think it's the white Scotch-Brite.
Yeah.
You can get from Lowe's or Home Depot. It's the least aggressive.
Yeah.
And I'll take a piece of that and I'll, you know, a 2-inch square piece, and I'll rough it up on a piece of glass just to make it a little softer before I use it on plastic.
Yeah.
And then with a very, very soft touch, I will Scotch-Brite the inscribed lines, making sure that I move the Scotch-Brite 90 degrees to the inscribed line.
Gotcha.
And that takes all the burrs off the side, pretty much. You know, don't. I also don't hesitate to very carefully run the scriber again through all the lines one more time after doing that to get all
just
the dust.
Just to pull the dust out.
Yeah, exactly. That's why scribing is so much work. So you pilot line, then you deepen the line, and then you take care of the burrs, and then you have to go back if you're serious and with a small, you know, scriber and get the dust out of the line. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, which is A, why you should be careful with what you eliminate, because the more you eliminate, the more you have to rescribe. And two, this makes me really, really admire these modelers who take an older model with raised lines.
Yep.
And they rescribe everything.
Yep.
I mean, that to me is just an amount of effort that I stand in awe of.
Yeah, I agree. I've not done it. I've seen guys at the Nationals that have, you know, rescribed an old kit, and it, you know, it, wow, you know, I don't have the patience.
Yeah.
I just don't. But before we get to actually a few options you have for rescribing an outscribed model, next in my outline, anyway, I don't know about yours, is filling an area in preparation for having to put a scribed line through it.
Oh, that is an excellent, excellent point.
So as usual with me, it's always an aircraft, you know, reference. So again, we go to our P-40 or our Spitfire or Mustang and the wing fillets. And in a situation like that, let's say you're going to have to put some filler in there in order to make everything right. And when you do, you know, you're going to put that filler right over or, you know, on the top of multiple inscribed lines that are going to be filled in with the filler.
Right.
So now some guys can use the Mr. Surfacer 500, Mr. Surfacer 1000, which is very, very soft. And they can, you know, put that on the area, let it dry, blend it in. And then they have the touch with a scriber that they can ever so gently scribe through those puttied areas and not have the scriber dig in and cause a hole.
Or worse yet, chip.
Yes. I'm not one of those guys.
I'm there with you. And that is if you are rescribing over an area where you have used filler, the two big problems are that it's the material you're scribing through changes texture between the plastic and the fill material. And it is so easy with the fill material, depending on what you're using, to, as you're ever so delicately rescribing that line, a little chip will pop off.
Yeah.
And it's just enough to make that line look like it's been rescribed through filler material and chipped.
And the most challenging is, again, back to that rounded wing fillet.
Yep.
And you have a line of putty running 90 degrees to, you know, the curve of the fillet, if you will. And you're going to have to scribe through that curve, through the putty.
Yeah.
And I never could develop that touch. I got a friend of mine that is a very, very good modeler that does have that touch, can scribe through it. I can't. So what I have been using for years, and I talked about this before, is CA glue and talcum powder.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about CA and talcum powder is you can vary the proportions of talc and CA. And when you combine the two, they combine, you know, quite nicely, actually. And it makes kind of like a toothpaste kind of consistency. Now, the more talc you put in, okay, the softer that material will be when it's dry. If you put more CA in relative to talc, the harder the material will be when it's dry.
Right.
So if I'm working with an Airfix kit, which has pretty soft plastic, I know just from experience to add a bit more talc than CA and come up with a filler that has roughly the same density as does the plastic I'm working with. If I was doing an old Fujimi Phantom with that hard plastic, I would mix my talc and CA at different proportions so that the resulting material, the fill material, would be harder and would be closer to the density of the plastic that I'm working with.
When you apply that mixture,
yeah,
do you use anything to accelerate its drying, or do you just let it set naturally?
No, I one of the things I like best about using CA and talc is that you can zip kick it.
Okay. And so you do use zip kicker?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Because unlike Mr. Surfacer or any of the putties where you're going to put that on, and if you work with those putties, you know, you can probably sand it in 3 or 4 hours, but
I usually give it 12.
Exactly. It's usually best to go overnight to make sure it's going to sand well.
Because it dries on top first before it dries under.
Yes, exactly.
And so you think it's dry and you start sanding and you hit wet putty.
Yep. Yep. Whereas with CA talc, once you fill the area in with the material, then you take a little drop of zip kicker, put that on there, and that hardens in about 30 seconds. And then you can take after it with a file or a sandpaper or do whatever you got to do because it's ready to go. So that's one more reason I like using it. But the main reason is, let me give some proportions here. If you're sitting at your bench and I'm going to mix up some CA talc filler, mm-hmm. I will take an amount of talc about as round as a nickel. Okay.
Yeah.
And maybe mound it up 2 or 3 millimeters. Okay. And then I'll put a little depression in the middle of that nickel sized, amount of talcum powder. And inside the depression, I'll put maybe 3 or 4 good sized drops of CA. And the CIU is not the thin stuff. You want to use the gap filling stuff. And I like the medium stuff by Bob Smith Industries and the purple label. I'll put 3 or 4 good sized drops of medium CA into that nickel sized dollop of talcum powder. And then with a toothpick, I'll incorporate the two. And it immediately takes on a toothpaste kind of consistency. It gets thicker with time. So you have to work with it a little quickly, especially if you want it to be more liquid and you want it to flow, then you want to mix it and get it on the model quickly. But the other thing that's nice about this stuff, and I don't know if you've ever used it this way, is if you're going to be filling like a hole in the side of a model, just a perfectly right. round hole, and you're going to want to sand that flush after it's dry. The nice thing about the CA talc mix is that after it starts kicking off, it goes through a stage right before it becomes completely hardened that it has the consistency of cheddar cheese. And it cuts with a knife or an X-Acto beautifully. So you can put the CA talc into the area that you're filling, wait a few minutes for, you know, it to start kicking off, grab your blade and carve it and carve a lot of the excess off before you zip kick it.
So then let's go on to where you have scribed and for whatever reason you have scribed imperfectly.
So and for this, that, you know, let's say, you know, again, you're rescribing a remnant of a line, and you got a little anxious and didn't, you know, do a really good pilot line, put pressure on too early, scriber comes out of the line, and as it always does, takes a big, you know, hunk of plastic out with it. For that, I go right to CA and talc.
Okay. I was going to ask what your go-to for that was.
Yeah, again, because for me, that is the stuff that's going to scribe the most like plastic. And it's also going to blend and sand the most like plastic.
Well, and it's another thing, when you're scribing and your scriber jumps the line or wanders or goes off where it should, if it doesn't take a chunk of the plastic out, but merely cuts the plastic, you can actually take the blade of your scriber and 90 degrees to the cut, drag the blade flat along it. And a lot of times it will put the plastic back where all you've got to do is polish it with a little sandpaper, and it'll put it back like it was, and you won't be able to really see where your blade wandered off.
Yep.
Now, what I've encountered when that happens is you then have to reverse your scribing direction.
Yes.
Because the tendency will be to re-wander at that exact same point.
Yep. So this happens a lot. Let's say you have a line that's running parallel to the leading edge of a wing, and you have to rescribe that line. And for some reason, there's a little blob of something in the remnant of the line that you're rescribing. And when this blade hits that little blob or whatever, it jumps out of the line momentarily and gives you a little curve, and then it pops back into the line.
Right.
At that point, you're done. Because a lot of guys will go, no, I can save this. I'll just keep rescribing, and I'll put pressure against, you know, the other side of the curve. And I'll straighten the line. No, you won't. You'll just make the line deeper with a curve in it.
Yep.
I've done it so many times myself.
Oh, I have too, because it's the natural tendency.
It is.
Let me fix this. If you reverse the scriber and go the other direction,
yes,
you don't ever hit that jump point to have it wander off again.
Yes. And not turning the scriber around and continuing thinking you're going to scribe your way out of it is just like I've seen guys try to paint away runs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So at that point, again, if I can turn, like you say, if I can turn the scriber around and get it from the other way and make it straight, well, you know, then I saved it. If right. I can't, I just, okay, fine. I'll grab my CA and talc. I'll fill it in. I'll sand it down, blend it in. And then usually when I'm going through, let's say it's a straight line, and I'm going through that area that's been filled with CA and talc, I usually use the push end of the UMM scribers.
Yeah.
And I'll push that end of the scriber through the putty first to get it started. And then I'll very carefully turn it around, the scriber, and use the pulling end and actually deepen the line ever so carefully. But that's, again, where the UMM scribers come in really handy, is pushing the line through these filled areas as opposed to having to pull the line through them.
And that is, again, going back to these UMM scribers, the fact that they have both of those, both the push and the pull on the same tool.
Right.
Because most scribing tools, you know, to go back to the Squadron dental tool thing, there's no push and pull. It's just pull.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's it. John put a lot of thought and time into those tools when he did. And again, as you said earlier, those tools came from a modeler off of a modeler's bench.
Yep.
So and they
fit. They fit so naturally in your hand; it's not funny.
Yep, agreed.
I mean, it's amazing.
So the last thing on my outline here is what you brought up earlier, and that is, you know, to rescribe outscribed lines or not. That is the question.
Okay.
And one thing to approach this is, if you're thinking about rescribing all of the outscribed lines on a model, and it's a large model, I've got the old 1/72 scale space shuttle.
Yep.
Which I'm dying to build, but it's all outscribed. And so,
what you mean is raised panel lines.
Yeah,
right?
Raised panel lines, outscribed, exactly, in relief.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so, you know,
and it's in white plastic, the best, yes. The best plastic to rescribe in.
Yeah, yeah, and it's huge. I mean, by 72nd scale standards, oh, yeah. That is a big model, right?
Yep.
So at that point, when you're looking at that, you think about, you just consider counseling a little bit, probably. And if counseling doesn't work, you have a couple of options here before you commit to actually rescribing the entirety of that model. One option is, and it involves a little bit of a technique, but you can knock those outscribe or in relief lines down, buff them down a little bit so they're not so proud. And then after you build the model, you can, if you develop the technique, use a little bit of enamel panel liner and let the panel liner run along the length of the outscribed line. And it gives you kind of a shadow that runs parallel to the outscribed portion of the line. Now it's not as good as inscribing it, but it can save you, you know, potentially weeks.
Hundreds of hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And guys who have developed this technique, I actually saw the shuttle done, and this is what whoever built it, you know, this is what he did. He knocked all the lines down and then used an enamel panel liner to just highlight them. And he clearly had his technique because you could see where the enamel panel liner was removed, leaving just the faintest hint of a shadow where it's up against the inscribed line. And from 2 or 3 feet away, it looked absolutely beautiful.
You're tricking the eye is basically
what you're doing. Yes, completely.
Now, the other technique I've heard, if you've decided that sanity is not for you and you're going to completely rescribe a raised panel line model, one of the things that I heard people who've done this, and I've done it once myself, the old Hasegawa 72nd scale zero when it was raised panel lines before they redid it with inscribed panel lines. Mm-hmm. But in any model like that where you have raised panel lines, go to the point where all of the panel lines, where panel lines intersect with each other, and drill a hole, very fine hole. Then you sand away all the panel lines, and you have these holes that become like a connect the dot feature.
Wow. You're going to have to fill those holes, though.
Oh, yes. You're right. The holes get filled, or what they do. I mean, you're not making big holes. They either, if you can do it delicately enough, they become part of the panel line.
Right. But, I get you now. Right.
But if not, you're right. You have to do some filling that you're then going to rescribe through. But at least gives you the ability to lay down straight edges and draw lines.
What might be easier is to actually use the outscribed lines as guides. And for this is where something like the 001 or 2 would be ideal. Once you actually, you know, you develop the touch with it and use the outscribed lines as guides.
Yeah. And just simply run along next to them.
Just run along next to them and get to the point where you've got, you know, half a millimeter, quarter of a millimeter, you know, enough depth so that when you go back with your sandpaper, buffing tools, whatever, to take the outscribed line down, you'll leave the inscribed line. And, you know, for those areas, I've done this a little bit, you know, with some aircraft models. And for those areas where you have the entire model is outscribed, and you have a 90 degree, where a cross, if you will, where two lines meet at 90 degrees.
Yeah.
So I'll take the shortest of the two, and let's say the vertical is shorter and the horizontal is longer. I'll take a little notch out of the vertical line where I'm going to be scribing on the horizontal line. Did that make any sense?
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense.
So you get this nice, you know, the longest line is what the eye is going to catch, right? So you notch all the vertical ones going into the longest line scribe that longest line. And then again, not to beat a dead horse, but where the UMM tools come in handy is pushing. And that's where, when you have those areas where you, you know, have just maybe a half a millimeter, you know, that you have to connect, that's when you can turn the tool and push, you know, push the blade to connect your lines. It's a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. No, listen, you know me, life is too short to build old crappy kits. I cannot think of a kit that I would be so motivated that I would completely rescribe a race panel line model.
No, I can't either. The only one is the shuttle, as I said. And then every time I look at that box, I just shake my head and walk away. And
I agree. I completely agree.
Well, that's so, about it on my outline here, guys, driving.
We're right at an hour. And can you think of anything that we haven't covered? Mike, do you have anything that you want to ask him?
John, you brought us a long way from scribing, you know, the basic plastic, the fillers to use, to the tools to use. And I hope now I've got some courage to do this, because this is where I always come up short. I always sand out some lines and I have to go back and do them. And just thank you for coming back on again and helping us through some of this.
Yeah, not a problem. Scribing is, as we started with, scribing is a necessary evil for those who, you know, take the sport seriously. But a couple of tricks, and the big thing I think with scribing is the tools.
Yep.
And once you get the right tools in hand and patience, it's a technique that can be at least made palatable, if not enjoyable.
Yep. No, I completely agree.
All right, guys, I enjoyed it.
All right.
You take care.
You too.
Well, Mike, we're getting to the end of the episode, which means in theory, you're getting to the end of the modeling fluid. Now, since you're reprising an old favorite, I hope that there's no surprise.
There is no surprise, man. And I tell you, I'm really vindicated on this one, because I don't ever know what other folks are going to like. But since I got introduced to this one, we've gifted it to somebody. Well, my wife's boss is who it was. He loved it. We've had a couple of listeners post photos of the bottle to us or to the dojo.
Yep.
And then somebody else said something. I can't remember who it was.
Yeah.
Russell's Reserve, 10-year aged. It's just really good.
Well, you can't go wrong with a 10-year. I mean, that adds so much body. And so many of the subtle flavors by aging it that long. So, yeah, I can see how that's a good one. I think
10 to 12 is kind of a sweet spot, in my opinion.
I completely agree.
For the price, this is highly recommended. Russell's Reserve, 10-year, highly recommended. We're going to have to take a bottle up to Canada.
That's what I was going to suggest. We're going to need to take a bottle to Canada, and we're going to need to have some in the dojo down in San Marcos.
That's right, man. Well, how's your beer, man?
Actually, I just finished it up. It's quite bright Belgian-inspired wheat ale by Bell's from Comstock, Michigan. 5.0% ABV and very, very light, very refreshing. Since it's only 5%, it's certainly something that I wouldn't be worried about going out and mowing the lawn while drinking it, because it's got a good flavor to it. I really enjoyed it. That's my first time trying it, and I definitely would drink that again.
Well, folks, there's two solid thumbs up.
There you go. So, Mike, do you have any shout outs before we sign off?
I do, Dave. First, I want to shout out all those who've helped Plastic Model Mojo financially by contributing either through Patreon or PayPal. Those would be Mr. Mark DeRamus, Brad Ralston, Jason Campbell, and John Bryan. Those folks have all contributed either through PayPal or our Patreon page. And if you'd like to join these folks in helping out with the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/plasticmodelmojo. And at Patreon, you can make a recurring contribution from any amount from a dollar on up. And Patreon will handle the billing and you can just let it ride. If you don't like that system, I don't care. You can do it however you want. You can go to PayPal. And if you want to contribute through PayPal, you can go to www.plasticmodelmojo.com. And in the upper right hand corner of the homepage, there's a heart icon that will take you to PayPal unless you make a one time or your own managed recurring contribution there. Any amount you want, down to the penny. It doesn't really matter there at PayPal, but, however you choose to do it, the fact that you've chosen to do it makes us very happy and very appreciative because it's helping us get a lot done around here. It's paying for a lot of stuff to help bring you this show. And we're having a lot of fun doing it, and we really appreciate it. We appreciate the feedback, and glad you're enjoying it, and I'm glad you're enjoying it enough to show us a little love with your wallet. So thank you very much.
Amen. I'll second all of that. It's fantastic, and it's a really great help to us. My shout out of the month is to somebody who will never hear it. My lovely wife, the model wife, shout out to her for supplying me with new modeling fluid so that the listeners get to hear, new beers, new bourbons and whatever every episode. So I was lucky. I married well. I highly recommend it to those of you, out there. If you're not already, find yourself a woman who will buy you a six-pack of beer.
You know what you can tell her next time, Dave?
What?
Old Forester has packaged their Whiskey Roast series of three bottles in a whiskey tasting set.
Oh, you're right. I've seen that.
And I guess they're probably like 325-milliliter bottles. Yeah. They're smalls.
Yeah.
Like half size.
That's a good idea.
It ain't cheap. I mean, yeah, for bourbon, it's still cheap, but
yeah,
you know, it's like 80 something bucks.
Well, that's great. I'll have to do that. That's diabolical. All right. Good. I'll do that.
Well, Dave, we're at the bloody end again.
Yep. You know what they say, Mike. So many kicks.
So little time, Dave.
See you on the other side. All right.